Rise and shine! It's a great day in the North Woods!
Hello everyone! Indeed, it is a great day in the North Woods! And it's a great day for a podcast episode. I'm John Bergman, I'm the host for this one. And today we're looking back on the 1960s. That's a decade that we've spotlighted before with guests, but it was just such a magical and important decade at Voyager. There just seems to be an endless supply of great stories and great memories from the people who were part of camp in that era. And I certainly love hearing from all of them. To that point, today's guest is Tom McKenna, who was a camper from 1962 to 1964, and then there was a gap year for 1965, and he returned to camp from 1966 to 1968. Tom and I get into a lot in this conversation, but as a bit of a teaser, I'll say that Tom was the very first person to do something very important in camp's history. He possesses a very notable Voyager first, you could say. So stay tuned to hear what that is. We talk about a lot of other stuff too, including those legendary train rides up to camp, the staff in the 1960s, the fire circle. It's all kind of jam-packed into this episode. So I don't want to spend any more time on this preamble. Let's just dive right in because I think you will enjoy hearing from Tom as much as I did. Here is my conversation with Voyager alum Tom McKenna. Tom McKenna, thank you for visiting this virtual campsite, coming on to the Camp Voyager podcast here. I am really thrilled to talk to you. And I was, as I was getting ready for this, I was thinking, oh, this is the Tom McKenna. This is a name. This is the guy. I've seen your name on, I feel like, so many plaques in the mess hall over the years, just all the times that I've sat in the mess hall at the tables during meals and during evening programs, staring at all the plethora of names and years and all the great accomplishments. Your name in my head seemed to be one that, oh, that's like a marquee plaque name. But then right before I pressed record here, it occurred to me that the reason I think of you as a key plaque name is probably because you, correct me if I'm wrong, you are the very first name on the Battleship Island swim plaque, which is to say you pretty much invented the Battleship Island swim. And so that seems like probably a fairly random place to start our conversation, but I was too excited at that realization to start anywhere else. So please tell me the story of how you invented the Battleship Island swim as an activity and then as something to be on a plaque for.
Well, you know, I love the swimming, and I wasn't thinking about a plaque at the time, but you know, my first year, I swam Vicky, and I swam Indian also as an 11-year-old, and you know, that to me was a big accomplishment. Oh boy, you know, 2.5 miles, and every year we'd swim Vicky and Indian, and so I don't remember what year it was, 66, 67, maybe, and Battleship, we used to always paddle out to Battleship. And so I convinced a couple people to follow me in a canoe. And I can't remember who it was. It might have been Dave Casey and a camper, but bless their hearts, you know, because it's a long way over to Battleship and back. And, you know, I wasn't sprinting. So it just, you know, it just seemed like one, oh, let's do that. You know, let's try Battleship. And, you know, the fact that other people did it too, and it became a plaque. That was kind of just a bonus thing. I had never thought about it from that standpoint.
Yeah, and actually, I should correct myself. Maybe it wasn't a plaque when you did it, because what happened was years ago we found scrawled on the walls of Cabin 7, somebody had made just a makeshift kind of notation of Battleship Island swimmers, people that had done the swim over the years. And I guess people had just added their names to the list. Somebody, God bless them, had kept track and just added to that list in Cabin 7 over the years. And it was, you know, a while ago that we said, well, we should really put this on a plaque in the mess hall to go along with, like you said, the other swims and whatnot. So yeah, maybe it wasn't even thought of as a plaque accomplishment when you did it. I don't even know if you knew that it was being recorded for posterity in Cabin 7.
Yeah, it was just one of those things. You know, you're a camper. You had a lot of room to figure out what you wanted to do, and camp was supportive of stuff like that. So I thought, all right, I'd try Battleship.
Yeah, well, how did you think? I mean, I guess it might be lost to time, the memory, or maybe it was just a random thing. But I mean, there are other, you could have done the swim to Dead Man's Rapids. You could have done to Haystack Rock. There are kind of other landmarks, Churchill Island and whatnot. How did you choose Battleship?
Yeah, it just seemed to be the one island that, you know, we used to paddle out to, and we'd go by it. I think we'd go out by it on the way to Clear Lake maybe or something. It seemed kind of doable and novel, and what the heck, you know.
Well, it lives on now. We have a few campers that do it. Not every year, certainly, because it's such a long swim. But every several years, there will be a camper or two that do the swim, and it's a huge accomplishment. And it all started with you. So it's an honor to be talking with you for many reasons. That the Battleship Island swim among them. But
yeah,
let's backtrack.
That may be my claim to fame, I guess. Yeah.
One of many claim to fame in camp lore, I think. Let's backtrack a little. Tell me a little bit about your background and sort of the how, when, and where you were as a kid and how you found your way to camp.
So I started camp. My first summer was 1962. I posted a little picture of Cabin 1. I was 11 years old. And still remember those guys' names. It was just incredible. But we lived in Greencastle. My dad was a professor at DePauw. My mother played bridge with Mim regularly. You know, I have sisters who are Debs and Vicky and John's and Charlotte's age, kind of, you know, we all. So the families were kind of close. Greencastle's a little town. And, you know, as soon as I could, I wanted to go to Camp Voyager. So at 11, I went up for 4 weeks. And every letter home was, can I stay eight? Can I stay eight? And, you know, I got back from one of my trips during the first 4 weeks, and my parents had relented, and yay, you know, so I got to stay 8 weeks. And then in 1966, we ended up moving from Greencastle to Monmouth, Illinois. My dad got a job at Monmouth College. And, you know, there, Gene Binkie was my football coach, and he taught math at the high school, and he had a daughter, Anna, who was my little sister, a little older than my little sister. But, you know, and somehow I think Charlie was asking Dad if he knew anyone that be interested in helping out in the summers. By then, Babe was getting a little on in years, and, you know, they wanted to get someone else to help out with some of the program stuff. And I, Dad thought of Gene, and so he kind of reached out to Gene, and Gene was all for it. And, you know, Gene became, you know, it's such a huge part of camp. And so I was, you know, I had him as a football coach, a math teacher, camp director, you know, just a huge impact on my life, as so many people at Camp Voyager were. I mean, Charlie, of course, Babe, and, you know, the counselors. Here are these kids, virtually, you know, 19, 20, 21. But, you know, when you're 11, 12, 13, they know everything. And, you know, you just learned so much, and you idolized them and followed through. I mean, and just to kind of touch on that idolizing thing, you know, when Tom Bowes and Carl and Bob Toom, you know, went on that first Hudson Bay trip and then they did the Dubon River after that, you know, and you're sitting there as a, you know, 12, 13 year old, and you're going, holy smokes, you can do that. You can do that. I mean, those guys were like opening up the world to me. And say, boy, that sounds, I want to do something like that someday. Never got to do any of those great big trips. You know, I end up in Alaska, which I guess in itself is a little bit of a trip. And I happen to be living in Kotzebue, which is way up there when that, one of the trips, this, I think they said 79, they came from Dawson and went up and came down the Noatak River. And there I was walking down French Street, and these canoes come paddling by, filled with former voyagers, and you know, a couple of those guys I knew from camping, and a couple of them were, you know, a little younger than me. But you know, I knew they were coming. It wasn't like, oh, look at that, but it was really exciting to see that part. My life kind of meet up with voyagers there.
Did camp really instill in you, I mean, was it camp that instilled in you an appreciation for these more rugged places, these wild places? It sounds like that's kind of a continuing lifelong thing for you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the wilder, the better. I mean, I went to Alaska as a VISTA volunteer. And when I first applied, you know, they said, well, you could go to this place or this place or this place. And I said, well, let me just check it because I don't know my Alaska geography. And I'll get back to you. And, you know, I ran to the library. That was in 75. And National Geographic had just happened to have the Alaska map in that month's issue, June 75, I think. And I looked at all the places, and Kotzebue was the furthest out there. And I ran back and said, I'll take Kotzebue. Anyone get that one yet? Well, nobody wanted to go there, it turns out. But, you know, it fit me perfectly. I ended up staying 9 years in Alaska, so.
What are some of the similarities that you've noticed between the Boundary Waters area and Alaska? Because I've never been to Alaska personally, but I certainly look at the pictures and kind of minus the mountains that you notice in Alaska. I'm kind of like, yeah, I see this kind of looks in some ways like the wilds of northern Minnesota. What parallels did you notice?
Well, just being up there, you know, you're in the wilderness, which is kind of the whole thing with Voyager 2. You know, when you're 11, 12, 13, you take that stuff for granted. You don't have any idea that, you know, being out on a long trip and maybe seeing a couple other canoers along the way, you know, that just isn't in everybody's everyday life. And, you know, a lot of people in Alaska, you know, especially the part I was in, you know, they like camping. They like being out. And, you know, one of my friends from high school, Dave Fleming, his brother Mike was a counselor at Voyager for 1 or 2 years, and he was a DePauw graduate, but Dave never went. But you know, he and I were in Alaska together for many years in the winter, you know, living out in the bush and sod igloos and tents and mushing dogs. And you know, it just was kind of an extension of what Charlie instilled in you. You know, don't leave any footprints, you know, just don't leave anything but footprints, I guess. You know, just go out and be in the wilderness. And it definitely was what got me going, thinking Alaska might be an exciting place.
I want to circle back to, you mentioned Gino Behnke, and what were some of the qualities? I was fortunate enough to meet him and talk to him a number of times, but I never was a camper under his tutelage when he was the program director. And I think in some ways there's an argument that could be made that camp is, it would be good for anybody. Working at camp would be good for anybody. But then every once in a while you meet a certain person in life and you think, wow, this person would be really great to work at camp. And I think sounds like Gino, I mean, he certainly fit the bill. I mean, he became such a legend in a lot of ways. And so can you talk a little bit about Gino's personality and kind of some of the aspects that made him such a good fit for being the program director and so influential to so many campers?
Gene was a man of integrity. He really, you know, when he was my football coach, you know, he wasn't one of these guys is, you know, playing the big band and get out there and win at every cost. You know, he was building, you know, just like Ted Lasso, I'm building the people. I'm not building the team. I don't care if we win or lose that much. You know, I'm building the people. And he was someone that we, as high school kids, could look up to. And I think, you know, he just had that quiet way about him, and he showed that he cared for you. He never got upset. He always, if you wanted advice, he had it, but he wasn't over there preaching to you all the time. He just kind of exemplified that life of, you know, interacting with your fellow person and being a great human being. And he was able to pass that on.
I think that that's such a key to the camp experience. And it's kind of funny because when you think of being at camp, a lot of times the first thing that comes to mind are the fun activities, of course, and the beautiful scenery that you get to paddle and portage through and around all the trees, all the lakes. But when you kind of dig deeper in your mind, it's really the people that stand out as the reason. People. Yeah.
And you can start with Charlie. I mean, just Charlie was another guy. You know, you look at his history and the things he's done and all the things he did. You know, he's got the great natatorium named after him. You know, I don't know what he was doing at DePauw. You know, I don't know what my dad was doing at DePauw when you're a kid, you know. But, you know, I didn't learn any of that stuff about Charlie. You know, he never bragged about it. He never talked about it. But, you know, he told me stuff sometimes, like, I don't know how it came up, but, you know, when you're out camping, make sure you wash the dishes really well, he said. Make sure you wash them well. You know, when I was in the war, a lot of guys weren't taking care of their dishes and they got dysentery and didn't feel good. You know, you got it. Here I am, 72 years old. These lessons, just little words, you know. During the Olympics, I remember, you know, I had my own team one time and, well, how's it going? You know, and just little things here and there, making sure you're doing things fairly. But, you know, I think that moving along in a quiet way and not tooting your own horn, just being there. And, you know, those guys had lots to toot their horns about, but you never heard about that. You know, they were there to support the group.
Yeah, I think humility is something that camp teaches really well, not only the people there, but also just the experiences of remaining quiet and calm to your point and humble to your point, because you know, okay, yeah, this portage might be easy and you might have raced across it and you're feeling great, but hey, there's another portage that might get the best of you, right? It's kind of like moving through the wilderness, I think, really teaches you to be, to have some of that humility.
And I think, you know, Charlie and Min did a great job in recruiting staff, and probably Gene and Babe were in on that too. But like I mentioned, you know, you got these college kids, you know, they're really kids. And, you know, I think of them, you know, the Thomas brothers, Ole and Mike, and then another friend of theirs, Rick Farrell, he was built about the same. And those three guys are just these big burly hulks. But, you know, Johnny Vital was a, I think, a DePauw student that was up there. It had a big impact on me. You know, just so many great counselors and older campers too would come along. You know, and point you in the right direction and give you encouragement and that kind of thing. I, you know, as an 11, 12 year old, I got a lot of attention from the older campers, and that was fun. I have a couple of little stories so we don't run out of time. And I do want to just say that, you know, these are my memories as I've consolidated them, and they may not be factual, and people listening may go, oh, no, or that's not the way it was. And, you know, and maybe I'll embellish a little, but, you know, really it's how it got consolidated in my mind. And I just want to put that caveat in there.
You're acting like a fish tale has never before been told at Camp Voyager.
I mean, sometimes you got to add a little bit of spice, but most of this stuff is pretty true. And I'll be interested in other people who were in there during my years, if they can talk about it. But, you know, well, I was just thinking to start, you start the train ride. So, you know, June 20th or something, 1962, my folks drove me from Greencastle up to Indianapolis, meet the train. And there's another little kid there going up there, another 11-year-old from Indianapolis, Jim Nicholson. You know, put these kids together. Well, you know, Jim and I, bunkmates all the way through, kitchen crew together, still exchange Christmas cards. You know, I mean, huge, just a huge thing. You start these relationships. And so then there we're on the train ride, and the old Pullman cars and the porters that put them down. And, you know, I'd never been in a overnight train before. And you're with all these people from camp, and you're running around, and some couple of teenagers or 20-year-olds are trying to take care of all these kids. I mean, I think Mim said it in an interview when that John Behnke did in his movie, you know, you've got these people's children. It's such a responsibility. I mean, I can't imagine. But anyway, so you got a couple of college kids looking after, I don't know, 30 or 40 of us running around, all different ages, you know, 11 to 17. And God, I mean, there you go. And then you get up to Duluth or Superior, and they put you on the bus and take you into camp. And okay, you're 11 years old, and I'm just thinking, okay, I ran into camp, and you know what was it? And you know, well, so you go to the cabins. You know, oh, you're going to be in cabin one. Oh boy, well, we got this group of kids whose names I still remember 60 years later. You know, amazing. And some of them I went to camp for a couple of years with, and Jim, of course, many years. But you're in there, and you've got, you know, you have your inspections. You got to know how to make your bed. You got to know how to get along with all these kids. And you know, we had to write letters home. They really, Mim was a stickler. You got to write your letter home. And I think it had to, I don't know if you had to give it out. You had to give it on Saturday or something. And if you didn't write a letter home, the threat was you couldn't eat, you know? And so I remember the story. I'm not going to name any names, Jim, but somebody in cabin one or three, I can't remember, wrote a postcard home. Unfortunately, it was a postcard. Dear Mom and Dad, I can't eat dinner if I don't write you a letter. Love, Camper. Well, if it had been in an envelope, it might have escaped Mim's sharp eyes. But Mim's reading this, and she's going, not sending that one out. You know, had to write another letter. But once again, there you are, taking care of people's children. And, you know, they've got to be have a connection with the parents, and the kids could care less. But I, you know, that was just a funny story and maybe a little apocryphal, but dear Mom and Dad, I can't have dinner if I don't write you a letter. Love, Camper. And but Mim got it. Mim kept a close eye on everybody, and I give her a lot of credit for that. But you know, so then you're in the cabins, you've got your friends, and they're all your age basically within a year or so, you know, and you got your couple of counselors. And then you go out on your trips. And then you're mixed with the older kids and the younger kids, and you've got, you know, the counselor needs a sternman and another canoe carrier. And, you know, you learn how to carry a personal pack. You learn how to carry two personal packs. I'm ready for the utility. I can do the food pack. You know, there's all these kind of things that you did to your own ability and learned over time. And I just, the friendships across the ages and within the ages was really a great part that, you know, that tripping component that mixed you age-wise was important for me at camp. So then, you know, the cabins, and then you go to the mess hall, of course. Well, the food, you know, you can't miss the food. Flo Lady was the cook, as I recall, when I was there most of the time. And she had a whole group of the ladies. And, you know, even Deb was, you know, if I was 11, Deb was probably 7 or something. And she'd be running around the kitchen, but you know, Vicky and Charlotte, them, and there was a guy from Wheat. I can't say Olson, maybe last name Olson. Anyway, his wife, and always smiles when you go back and forth to the Dutch door there to pick up more food or whatever. And always, always great food and as much as you needed. That was great. And you know, I don't want to miss Tiny and Tiny's Donuts on Sunday morning, which always was great. And you were always hungry on Sunday morning because you'd been at the fire circle Saturday night having CCs, which stood for either cold cuts or Charlie Cheapies, depending on which who you were talking to about them. And, you know, we're like, oh, yeah, we're going to have Charlie Cheapies tonight. But they delivered on Sunday afternoon. We always got the big, great dinner on Sunday afternoon with chicken leg and thigh. And, you know, but so that reminds me just of being up at the fire circle. Another, you know, what another important place in camp and very spiritual. I think, you know, one of the things when I was in Alaska, I felt like my incoming signals weren't getting jammed as much. And I felt like I was out there in the bush, in the wilds, and I just felt like I was more spiritual and thinking about more things and all that. And I think the fire circle was kind of that way at camp. You'd get there and we'd have the quiet time and a lot of times to think about things in the fire circle. So that, and having that as an anchor all the time to go back to, and we were there, you know, once or twice a week, it was huge. And one of the things we used to do at the fire circle, well, we did our initiations, of course, which was very solemn, but I remember early on, we had this thing where we'd tell stories. People would get up and tell stories, and a lot of times scary stories and stuff like that. And at the end, Charlie would always get up, and he had this one story he'd tell. He'd tell about he was overseas and with family or something, and somebody got the plague or some bad disease, and they disappeared. And you know, the main character in the story who Charlie was telling it was as him, you know. You know, and they, no one knew where they were, and I didn't. I thought I was in like the Twilight Zone. Well, one of my first years, Bob Toom, I think he's probably the oldest Toom, he got up and he told the story before Charlie. Because Charlie would tell it, you know, every year. So by the time Carl was, or Bob was up there, he knew the story. So anyway, I didn't get there. The older campers were kind of laughing about that, but I didn't get the gist of it till later on. But that was kind of fun. And I just going circling back to Bob and Carl and Tom Bowes, those guys. But, you know, things that I remember, Bob too played saxophone and he played Peanut Butter and he would wail on that one early in the morning when you spread it on. I mean, it was like our theme for a couple of years from Bob. And then His next brother, Carl, who his nickname was Fingers, because the spelling of their name, T-H-U-M, no B, but so we always called Carl Fingers. And then, well, Tom and Carl both, you know, you had a lot of these families that went up there. It was really something, which reminds me of another story. So I was, 5 years ago or maybe a little more, I was working a place called Plum Island Animal Disease Center in New York. And there was this consultant guy. He either worked for Department of Homeland Security or consultant guy. His name is Dan Rickett. You know, he would come up and I'd see him once in a while. And one time he and I were at a meeting down in DC together. And we were in a breakout group of maybe 30 people. And the person hosting the meeting said, you know, why don't you just go around and say who you are, where you're from, da, 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 you know, just so we know who we got. So we're sitting there, and Dan goes, you know, Dan Rickett, grew up in Crawfordsville, Indiana, da, 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 and all of a sudden I went, Rickett, Crawfordsville? So, you know, there was a little break, you know, in a half an hour or something, a little while later. You know, I went over and, you know, I'd been working with Dan, you know, on and off for several months. I said, Dan, do you have a brother, Roger? And he gave me this really startled look. You know, it was that caught him off guard with that question. And I said, you know, Camp Voyager, Rickett, Crawfordsville. And he gathered himself and he said, well, I did have a brother, Roger, but he died when he was in college. He got cancer or something. And I said, oh, I said, I was at camp with Roger. And then we figured out Dan was there that same year, you know, in one of the older cabins. And then, you know, Dan and I kept track and told our camp stories and stuff back and forth. But here you are in the middle of nowhere and you run across this big Voyager connection, which I thought was really incredible. Well, moving on from the mess hall, then, you know, the activities, just everything we had at camp, you know, the basketball courts, the waterfront, the rec hall, the sailing, the water skiing, the fishing. We had a nurse. Mabel Burton was the nurse most of the time when I was there. I stubbed my toe a lot, but, you know, keep everybody healthy. Once again, you've got, I don't know how many, 50, 60 boys, and I just keep thinking of that huge responsibility. Fishing, you know, you're out, and Babe Wheeler was always giving you all the fish stories and, you know, the root beer at the Narrows. And I mean, Babe was the trickster. He was kind of Loki. You know, he always, I bit the hook on him on many of his tricks over the years. So that was great. And then the trips, as I said, you know, that mixing of the age groups, a little more one-on-one time with some of the counselors that you wouldn't otherwise spend time with. The 10-day trips. I mean, well, that was I don't remember too many of those early on, but I was too young maybe to be thinking about them. But just the talk of the Hudson Bay trip, those guys getting ready to go on that. And then you just, oh my gosh. And excuse me, you get those 10-day trips. Beaver House Lake was a great one. Crane Lake, the Namekan River, that was a good one. That early one we used to do was called Sioux Lookout. I don't remember if they still do that one or not, but Sioux Lookout was another good 10-day. And one of the stories that came back from that, there was one of the older campers when I was a kid. I can't remember his name. I think we called him Pretty Boy or something. But They said he packed peroxide instead of an extra pair of jeans for that trip because he was bleaching his hair. You know, that was like, oh, come on. You know, you gotta be tough. You can't be worrying about your looks. But that just, you know, just the people and the stories.
I do want to ask you, though, something you mentioned. You mentioned water skiing, and I want to ask you because I've seen your name or heard your name referenced as a great water skier at camp over the years, and I'm so curious how a guy from Greencastle becomes a renowned water skier. So did this all happen at camp, or did you have other skiing experience?
Well, I went to another camp when I was 10 in Pennsylvania, and there they had a little water skiing, and you had to go on the disc first before you could get on water skis. So as a 10-year-old, I kind of learned a little bit about it. But no, camp is where we really did a lot of water skiing. And then once I moved to Monmouth, we skied on the Mississippi all the time too. But Jim Nicholson and I set up a slalom course there off the dock from the mess hall, with, you know, Clorox cans. And he and I would go ski. We just ski all the time on that slalom course, man. That was great. But by then we were, you know, 16, I think. You know, earlier on we had to wait our turn and go with everybody else. I just remember Dave Casey driving the boat all the time. He was always, you know, happy to help us get out there and ski.
And at this time, was the regatta, the 4th of July regatta, was that a big thing? Because I've seen photos from 60s and 70s of these incredible canoe floats. That's not something we do anymore at camp, but it'd be fun to do it. But is that part of your era, the regatta?
Yeah, I don't know when they started, but the two, I remember my cabin, we had one float with Betsy Ross, and I was Betsy Ross sewing the flag on the float, because I think I might have had longer hair than everybody else at the time. I can't remember. And then one year I was Leif Erikson or somebody. I owned a pair of lederhosen. They made a fake. I can't remember what it was, but we did some of that, you know. And then, like the cabins, like that cabin one that I posted on Facebook, we made a dock. And that summer, all the cabins were making docks off their cabins. And, you know, we got in there and we loved making that dock. So you always had a project, something to do together. And it reminds me just the talent.
And were you, so I want to go back to this because you said that you, that cabin one dock is still there. And I was going into this conversation thinking the big Voyager first would be that you swam to Battleship first, but it sounds like you were also part of the crew, a first in its own way of building that cabin one dock. That's remarkable. That thing still stands.
Well, I probably had some good renovations over the years, because 60 years is a long time, but just the concept of it. And, you know, I think it's our counselors, Jim Songritz, who he was doing the craft cabin at that summer, the art guy, and Tim Carell, who we used to call Maynard because he almost had a beard. They must have helped us get started on that. You know, they had all these 10, 11-year-olds with time on their hands. You guys need to build a dock. And, you know, or maybe other cabins. I don't know if we decided first or, but, you know, pretty soon all the cabins were working on docks that summer. So I don't know if the counselors got together and said, we're going to do this, get the kids doing it. But yeah, that was fun.
I don't even know if you could do that now with all, I don't even know if there's like red tape, if you'd need a certain permit to build a dock. I don't know. I would imagine it might be a little less free flowing now than it was. So that's really cool.
Well, that, you know, that just reminds me. So at that time, state of the art, when we camped, we'd go out into the boundary waters. I don't even know. Seems like there were still motorboats. You could take a motorboat canoe, a motorized canoe, but you know, you would take your canned goods, you would burn your cans and take them out to the middle of the lake and fill them with rocks and sink them, and they would rust. You know, the idea being, there weren't enough people out there that by the time, you know, it would go back into nature, basically. You know, and now you never think of doing that. What? We didn't even have life jackets when I first started. I don't know. It just was a different time in the early 60s.
Yeah, it's just something, and I guess every decade is special in its own way for campers that were in attendance at the time, but it's just the 60s, there's just something about it. It just kind of seems to be just such a magic decade, which is why I'm always so excited to hear from people that were kind of living it back then and a part of it.
Well, and you know, I mentioned in one of my posts just how important camp was to me, and like I said, I think everybody on that Facebook must feel the same way. I mean, what a huge experience. And you know, just the people and the people and names I remember. So I could name that group from 60 years ago in my cabin. And you know, and I saw, you know, I saw Greg Lippert. You know, I remember when Greg was his first camper, and then he posted a picture with Spider Lockhart on there. Not, you know, I always, oh, Spider, you know, he kind of remembered me when I was his age, you know. And then, you know, the Eric Toom. I mean, he was just such a machine in the bow. And I just remember, God, I, you know, there's Eric. And then the older kids, you know, in John's cabin, Doug Bentley and Carl Toom. I mean, not Carl Toom, Carl Bowes. You know, I need a picture to remind me of who's all in there. Some guy, Donaldson. There was another guy from Indianapolis that he missed his girlfriend so much he was going to steal a canoe and paddle down to Indiana. I don't think he got far, but just those names, and they stick with you. And you know, because it was such an important time in your life, I don't know if it's your adrenaline, but you just remember these people and the impact they had on you, both up and down the age groups.
And we kind of started, and you mentioned being a cabin wanter, and something that I've thought about over the years is now, if I could tell myself, if I could go back when I was in cabin one, when I was 9 years old, my first day there, is there anything I would tell myself, like words of wisdom to impart? And so I'm curious to you, if you, especially as somebody who has continued this lifelong love of wilderness, you know, knowing now that it was going to be such an impactful experience, if you could sit your own self down, your 10-year-old self, and impart any wisdom or words of advice, is there anything you would tell your cabin one self?
Well, I think, you know, that be in the moment, which I think I totally was. And, you know, Mim and Charlie just made such a great environment for us to be in. And, you know, and it was by 1962, it was well established. It had been a camp for 10 years. There were traditions, and there were, as you said, that continuity of campers who'd been there over time. I'd just say, boy, you're lucky. Take advantage of every chance you get, and share it. Share it with everybody you can.
Thank you for listening to today's episode, and thanks to Tom for coming into the campsite to share some memories. If you enjoy what we're doing with this podcast, it helps if you tell other camp friends, spread the word on Facebook, or just hit the subscribe button or leave a star rating. Anything like that lets us know that you're digging what we're doing. Myself or my co-host Alex will be back again soon for another episode. Until then, it's still a great day in the North Woods. I hope you can go out and enjoy it. We'll see you next time.